The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to continue a conversation on karma that I've been exploring. And I'm just kind of looking at it from different perspectives each week. Needing to summarize the basic notion of what karma is to begin, so that everybody's kind of on the same page to start with. And also, as often with this group, I'd like to encourage questions during the talk, so that you don't have to feel like you have to wait. So just raise your hand if you have a question, and I'll explore it. I like this to be more of a conversation than a presentation, I guess. So the Buddha's teaching on karma is basically you've all heard the word, right? You've all heard this word and have some ideas about what it means based on the way it's used in our language. And yet it's got a pretty specific meaning in our tradition, in the Buddhist tradition. And it's somewhat different even than the way the word was used in other traditions of his day. And so it's interesting to look at what did he actually mean when the Buddha was talking about karma. And the way he explained it, is as a natural law, that it is a description, essentially, of human behavior. The natural law of human behavior, that our actions have consequences. This law essentially looks at the moment of our action, and not so much just at the action itself and what the action is, but the motivation or the state of mind that is inclining us towards that action. That motivation is really the crux of where the Buddha says this law of karma operates. And so this law of karma operates in terms of if we act with a motivation that is self-serving, that is contentious with the world, or confused. So those three flavors represent the mental attitudes of greed, the self-serving, of aversion, of the contentiousness, and delusion, of the confusion. So if we act out of those self-serving, contentious, or confused motivations, we are essentially cultivating confusion, greed, and contentiousness in our lives. So one of the ways the Buddha put this, I love this phrase, he says, whatever one frequently ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. So this is an expression of the way the natural law of karma works. And colloquially, we have the phrase, we reap what we sow. What goes around comes around. Those kinds of phrases essentially reflect this law of karma. So the that how we step into the moment, how we act, the motivations of our action, the only place we can impact that is right here in the present moment. The actions that we've made in the past, they're already over. We're not in the future, and so we can't choose how we're going to be acting in the future right now. What we can do is look at what our motivation is in this moment and begin to recognize how it impacts stepping into the future. One of the other interesting pieces, I think, about the Buddhist teaching in general is that the whole of the teaching is very reflective of this natural law. That the Buddha, you know, it's not his creation, this law of karma, but his whole teaching is in line with this law. That the ethical dimension of the Buddhist teaching comes out of the way that when we act out of self-serving, contentious, confused attitudes, it tends to take us more into confusion, greed, and self-serving and contentiousness in our lives. So it takes us in the direction of more and more struggle, more and more affliction, both in our own minds and in our world. So the seeing this, the ethics of the Buddha is kind of right in line with that. And the ethics of the Buddha is around, you know, what will make happiness arise in our minds? What will take us? What are the conditions that we that can be cultivated that will move us in the direction of a truer kind of happiness, a happiness not based in self-serving, contentious, confused attitudes. So what will take us more in that direction? What takes us in the direction of a truer happiness? So the ethics of the Buddha are really practical and in line with this natural law of karma, that if you want to be happier, then acting with the motivation of love, of kindness, of generosity, of wisdom, that will tend to take us more towards happiness. That when we act, when we frequently ponder love, generosity, compassion, kindness, wisdom, it creates more of that in our minds. So the ethics reflects this natural law, and it's very practical. It's not about you should do this because it's right, or it's you shouldn't do this because it's wrong. Do you want to be happy, the Buddha says. Do you want to be happy? Try not acting on self-serving, contentious attitudes and see what happens. So, you know, kind of looking at this choice that we have in the present moment. Another piece about the Buddha's teaching on karma that's somewhat different from the teaching on karma in his day is that the consequences, what happens as we step forward into the next moment when we act out of whatever motivation we act out of, the consequences are not deterministic. Some of the teachers in the time of the Buddha were saying, you know, well, if you did this action, you're going to, you know, have this consequence. You know, if you kill somebody, you're going to hell. You know, that kind of thing. Or, you know, if you behave in this way, that's going to be what happens to you. So there was kind of a sense of determinism with some of the teachings on karma in the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha's understanding of this natural law was more nuanced than that. And he said, well, you know, when we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, it tends to rebound on us with affliction, suffering, stress. The way that affliction, suffering, stress is experienced is not going to be deterministic. It will widely vary based on the conditions of your mind when you made that action, what you choose to cultivate in the future, and what you've chosen to cultivate in the past. And so there's this teaching analogy that the Buddha offers, that if you take a, a lump of salt and put it into a small glass, that water becomes undrinkable. And yet if you take that same small lump of water and put it into a large clear pool of water and then take a glass of that water, you barely taste, I mean, you wouldn't taste that salt. And so that's kind of the understanding or the exploration that, you know, it's possible that we might have a kind of an overall direction of our life that is very ethical, you know, that we're really working towards cultivating the wholesome qualities of mind, being generous and kind and friendly. And then we have, of course, these eruptions of confusion and self-serving and contentiousness that happen. And, you know, that of course that's going to happen. And that, you know, the consequences of that, he said, will be felt. But sometimes, you know, for some people that might be felt as a huge rebound of suffering and affliction. And for others it might, he said, be barely felt for a moment because of the kind of container in which that action with that motivation arose. So there's that sense that it's not, that's what he means when it's not deterministic. No, it's not just like if you do this, that's going to be the result. There's also another teaching story that's not so much a teaching story as it is a description or my understanding is that this is a story of a historical person who lived at the time of the Buddha and met the Buddha in his life. And his name was Angulimala. And his name means garland of fingers. The mala means garland, and Anguli means finger. And he had been going around killing people and cutting off one of their fingers and stringing it on a garland and wearing them around his neck, kind of as proof of how many people he had killed. And he was quite terrorizing the neighborhood. And people were afraid to go out, and you know, he was quite a feared person. And the Buddha had heard about him, and he at this point had supposedly killed 999 people. He was going for 1,000. He wanted to kill 1,000 people, and the Buddha put himself in Angulimala's path, and Angulimala's first thought was, oh good, here's an easy person to kill, you know, this is an ascetic, he's not going to, you know, have any weapons, you know, he's going to be really, you know, this is going to be easy, I can get my 1,000th person really easily. And the Buddha, the meeting with the Buddha, and I won't describe the way it was described in the suttas, but that meeting stopped Angulimala, stopped him in his tracks, and in this conversation with the Buddha pointed out and just somehow managed to turn his mind towards, what are you doing, Angulimala? You know, what are you doing? You're reaping suffering both for others and yourselves. And the Angulimala began practicing with the Buddha, became a disciple of the Buddha. And it is said that he became fully awakened. He completely uprooted greed, aversion, and delusion in his mind in his lifetime. Of course, the people in the neighborhood, you know, well, they respected the robes, and they respected the Buddha saying, look, Angulimala is a serious practitioner here. He's not going to kill anymore. No, and they believed the Buddha. So it's like, you know, in fact, the king was going out, you know, on a search party trying to find Angulimala, and he came into the Buddha's place, the place where the Buddha was staying. And Angulimala was standing next to the Buddha in his robes with his head shaven, and, you know, the king didn't recognize Angulimala because he'd apparently been quite wild looking or something. The king said, you know, you better watch out, Angulimala's in the neighborhood, you know, be careful. And the Buddha said, you know, what would you say if I told you that Angulimala has taken robes and has changed his life? How would you respond to that? And he said, I would respect that Angulimala had made that choice. And then the Buddha said, great king, this is Angulimala. And the king, it said the king, his hair stood up on the back of his neck. It's like, whoa, you know. So I think the king apparently had something to do with the fact that, because he was out ready to find Angulimala and drag him off to prison and execute him, basically. And so he didn't. But still, you know, the people in the neighborhood, he had killed a lot of people. You know, he had killed people that they, you know, their brothers, their fathers, their sons, their nephews, that he had killed a lot of these people. And so, you know, they weren't very kindly disposed to him. So he would go off on alms rounds, and people would, rather than giving him food, throw rocks at him, throw clods of dirt at him, and he'd come back with cuts on his head and, you know, a little bit of bruising and bleeding and things like that. And the Buddha's response was, and this is another interesting part of the teaching of karma, I think. I love this story as a karma teaching. Because the Buddha's response was, bear it, Angulimala. You are suffering here and now in the smallest way for which you might have suffered in hell for thousands of eons. So pointing there in that moment, so that's a showing essentially that his actions of the past had consequences. You know, it wasn't that he like went through and everybody loved him and, you know, everybody treated him really, you know, kindly and in a friendly way because of how he had been in the past. And yet, the Buddha's pointing was that if he had kept on that path, he would have experienced a much greater kind of suffering. So this is the that teaching again, that the consequences aren't deterministic of our actions. And what this one points to is not so much that, you know, in the salt crystal analogy, it's like, you know, you're dropping a salt crystal into either a small cup of pure water or a large pool of pure water, and that's kind of reflective of how you've been in the past. You know, have you been inclining towards beautiful states of mind? Have you been inclining towards skillful motivations in the past? In this moment, a little bit of unskillfulness erupts. That's like putting the salt crystal into a large pool of water. In this case, Angulimala had a huge truckload of salt in his mind stream. And essentially, what the meditation began to do was add purity, add pure water. You know, just continue, instead of continuing to add the salt, it was, you know, it's not so much that you take the salt out, but you add more and more purity, and the container gets, the entirety of the container gets more and more pure. So the experience, you know, given our choices now, even if we have done things in the past that were really not so helpful, even if we have a lot of that, this teaching really points to the possibility of transformation and that it is possible to change the course of your life and the consequences of that, you know, and the results. So for myself when I remember that, you know, there have been some ways and times that I've not been so skillful in the past, I remind myself of this story and how it is possible. It's like, you know, I haven't done anything nearly as bad as killing 1,000 people, you know. And yet Angulimala could transform his mind. I mean, I can only imagine what it must have been like, knowing how my mind works in meditation, you know, remembering past actions, you know, the way that past actions reverberate in the moment when the mind settles down. You know, how must his meditation have been, you know? It must have been extremely challenging to meet that mind over and over again. And so when I see in my own mind the way, you know, those things come up, it's like, bear it, you know? It's like the Buddha said, bear it. You know, you are experiencing here and now the suffering for something which, had you not shifted course, would have had much stronger consequences. Much more suffering, both in the world and in your own mind. So this teaching of karma both describes how we get caught, how we get stuck in our patterns. You know, that when we feed greed, aversion, delusion, it tends to cultivate more greed, aversion, delusion. And when we feed non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it tends to cultivate non-greed, generosity, non-aversion, friendliness, kindness, non-delusion, wisdom. So it cultivates those wholesome qualities. There's a I think it's a Native American story of the way I've heard it is that there is the grandfather talking to his grandson, and he's giving him a telling him what's going on in his experience. That he said, you know, there's these two wolves in my heart, and one is trying to tear me apart, and the other is guiding me towards wisdom. And the little boy said, well, which one will win? He said these wolves are kind of fighting in his heart. He said, which one will win? And the grandfather said, the one that I feed will win. So this is, again, that teaching. What do we nourish? What do we feed in our hearts? Are we feeding confusion? Are we feeding contentiousness? Or are we feeding generosity, friendliness, kindness? So the teaching of karma both points to how we get caught, how our minds stay confused, and how we can change course. This natural law of karma points to how we can free ourselves through choice, through action in the present moment that is based in these beautiful, wholesome qualities. So it's possible to change the course of our lives, as this Angulimala story so beautifully demonstrates. And it's the only place we can change this course, the only place, is right here in the present moment, by making skillful choices in the present moment. We can't redo the past, much as we'd like to. In a way, we have to open our hearts and, you know, forgive ourselves for the past. Because if we are continually looking back and saying, I wish I hadn't done that, I wish I hadn't done that, that was, you know, and beating ourselves up about it, there's a way in which the reviewing of the past, there's a way in which the looking at that and saying, yeah, that wasn't so helpful, that can be skillful. That's a kind of a conscience. You know, it's the recognition that those choices weren't so helpful. And that recognition helps us in this moment to choose differently. But it's not about reflecting on that and then saying, I'm such a horrible person because I made those choices. There's no, you know, I'm never going to be happy. I'm not going to be able to change the course of my life. That's kind of the deterministic view of our past actions. This teaching on karma is more hopeful in that, yes, it was like that, and I can choose differently. I can choose to step into the next moment with a kind heart, an open heart. So what gives us the capacity to choose skillfully right here and now? Mindfulness. If we are not aware of the present moment, then what we have frequently pondered, thought and pondered in the past, that's what's going to make our choices. That's how we're going to step into the next moment. If we are mindful, if we are aware in this moment, there can be a recognition of that intention, that motivation, and because of the mindfulness, there's a tiny little moment, a gap, in which we may be able to choose to not follow through on that action. There's one article I read. I think it was describing a study on the mind and the brain and that kind of thing. And the study said something like, you know, the choice that we have in the present moment, you know, the motivations of the past are quite strong and they're kind of guiding us to our choices. And, you know, that there's not so much this, the article was saying, you know, the choices of what we choose to do, and I'm not sure I believe this, you know, I'm not sure I believe this, but I'm just going to put it out there for reflection, okay? So just take it lightly as somebody's opinion. And this article said that it's not so much that we have free will. It's not so much that we can choose to act. But we have free won't. We can choose not to act. And there was some understanding that that moment of seeing, that moment when mindfulness is present, of seeing kind of the motivation or the direction that things are going, in that moment, there's that gap where we can choose not to do that. Yes?
What that's resonating with me, I'm just reading the
Eightfold Path.
Is the statement that we start with avoidance in rightful action or whatever.
Yes, avoidance skillful avoidance.
Step, then we get to choice about a different action. So maybe this writer is, that's just where
That's kind of what I was thinking too. Yes, I was thinking similarly. So I'll repeat this for the recording, it was reminding her that in the teaching of the Eightfold Path, that in effect we start with avoidance. You know, we start with the teaching on ethics. The teaching on ethics is very much a teaching on avoiding unskillful actions. And that's the first step, you know, that we can't really begin to cultivate the wholesome until we are avoiding the unwholesome. So and she said maybe that's just the place where the person who is doing the study was looking. And I think, you know, in large part, that is where we have to start. And so I would be curious about, you know, if they took somebody who had gone to that avoidant place, if they put that person in the study and, you know, began to look at that person's mind, you know, what might they see there? You know, what might they see in terms of choosing skillfully? And to some extent, too, You know, in fact, in some ways, the teaching of the Buddha is framed in terms of absence. So even the most wholesome, the highest state that we can, I don't know if actually Nibbana is not really a state, but the highest place or the highest result of practice is described not in terms of what we have, but in terms of what we don't have. So, freedom is described as freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from delusion. So, to some extent, you know, that also reflects that same notion of free won't, but I don't know. It's just I just wanted to put that out there because I thought that was an interesting way to frame the moment of the choice in the present moment. That often it is about free won't. You know, don't go there in that moment. So mindfulness helps us to choose to avoid the unskillful and begin to cultivate the skillful. So the choice in the present moment. There's a couple of ways this is framed. You know, first of all, there's the choosing not to engage in the unskillful. And that very choice begins to cultivate beautiful qualities in the mind. As we observe this, so this is where our karma begins to unfold and take us towards happiness. We choose to not engage with greed, aversion, delusion. And what happens is that we begin to recognize that in that very being aware of the arising of greed, the arising of aversion, the arising of confusion, which is, of course, harder to see, in the very being with that, you know, we start to see, oh, here's anger. And initially what we perhaps recognize as we see the arising of an unpleasant, difficult, reactive mind state such as anger, what we initially recognize is how painful it is. So that's essentially feeling the consequences of having that state of mind, right? So that's the results of that. There's this anger arising in the mind, and with mindfulness, the consequences become felt here and now of, oh, that doesn't feel so good. You know, the burning quality of anger in the present moment is essentially a consequence of having that anger arise. And yet that's a much more, a smaller consequence. Now, we may not trust that initially. We may not trust initially that the being present with that anger and the feeling of that anger being challenging, difficult, unpleasant, is a smaller consequence than what would happen if we acted on it. And yet even just a small, a reflection might have you recognize, like, okay, you see, for instance, a motivation of aversion getting ready to pop out in your mouth when you're getting ready to say something. And seeing that, you choose to not go there. And you feel in yourself the contraction, the frustration, the confusion. So in that moment, you're feeling the results of having that mind state pop up. And yet choosing not to act on it, you are essentially turning the direction from the consequences that would happen if it did come out of your mouth. You know, what would happen? You know, the saying that thing to that person, the rebound effect, the way they might explode, the way a relationship, you know, in a single sentence, a relationship of years can fall apart. Oh, use the mic. Go ahead and use the mic.
After attending your class last week, I began. I wanted to be more mindful of my reactions. And something occurred when my husband spoke to me in a degrading manner, which always
hurts.
Doesn't yes. hurt, just I react as uh-huh. a survivor, right? So he's saying something to me that made me want to do that. But in that moment of being mindful, what I saw was that it was his karma. And I stared at him in disbelief, first of all, that I had seen that. Mm-hmm. And there was no attempt on my part to respond, but in this shocked look on my face at the realization that it's not mine,
uh-huh.
he softened as he continued to speak. I never responded, but I laughed after. Uh-huh. Because I thought it was so exciting to think that it's not always me.
Yes.
So, I mean, and today you're telling me now, you're reinforcing what I learned last week. Hallelujah. I'm so grateful. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, beautiful. Thank yeah. you. That's a beautiful description. And that is true, that essentially in the mindfulness we do see, you know, well, everybody's their own karma machine, right? Everybody's doing the same thing. And, you know, when we begin to see how it unfolds in our own minds, a kind of compassionate heart begins to open.
Yes.
You know, it's like, wow, everybody's dealing with this. And we see, yeah, you know, that's that reactivity that other people are bringing into the world is a result of their own
yes.
karma. And they may not have the tools yet of being aware. So that's a beautiful example. Thank you. Yeah, Arthur.
So, yeah, you only touched on one piece of it that gives me some trouble. Very briefly, in talking about the possibilities of Angulimala's actions in other lives. And that's the piece of karma that I always struggle with. I don't know that struggle is the right word, but it doesn't exist in a way that I can verify it. I mean, pretty much everything. I see how my actions unfold.
Okay, yeah.
In the here and now, or next week, next month, makes perfect sense to me. That piece of the next life or the life after is a little difficult.
Okay, so in the Angulimala story in particular, I mean, I did mention that other people, you know, I said, Barrett, you're experiencing here now the consequences of what might have happened for lives to come. Yes, and so that's another piece. Let me just bring that in now, a little bit of that teaching, because the teaching on karma is intimately connected in the traditional teachings with teachings on rebirth. And that is an area that many of us... some of us feel very comfortable with, and it feels very natural to think about. And others of us, it feels not so sure about that part. You know, I see, and for myself, you know, I don't have any evidence in my own experience, either for past lives, or I will say I don't have any experience in my life that I interpret as evidence for past lives. The kind of experiences people talk about as evidence for past lives, I've had those kind of experiences, but I don't interpret them in that way. You know, the kind of experience of having a memory of some experience that feels like a memory, right? It feels like a memory, but you know it didn't happen in this life. That kind of experience is one that people sometimes use as evidence for past lives. So I've had that kind of experience. I don't interpret it as evidence for past lives. So that's just the way my mind is put together. So I don't have any, you know, intimations of the future, future lives. So I don't have personal experience with it. I feel kind of agnostic on this topic. I don't know. I mean, how can I know? You know, how can I possibly know what the truth is of that? Some people I respect very greatly do believe it. It's all over the Buddha's teachings. He clearly believed it. So the very That very belief of people that I greatly respect, that kind of weighs into the balance of maybe. You know, on the side of my own experience, it's more like maybe not. You know, so it's really, I don't know. So I want to put out, that's the perspective I come from. I come from the I don't know perspective. The teaching, the classical teaching, is that essentially this process, the process of cause and effect, the process of actions have consequences, the process of the motivations being a key part of what the consequences are. Boy, that I see in spades in this life. I see it moment to moment. It's very clear that that law of karma, that law of how human interactions unfold and how the mind unfolds and the possibility of seeing that when we act more skillfully, it takes us in a direction of more and more happiness. All of that, I'm down with. I get that. It really makes a lot of sense to me. So the traditional understanding is that that process, that kind of cause and effect, actions have consequences, the consequences rebound on us based on the ethical intentions that are associated with our actions. That process is understood to just be rolling on. And that process doesn't end when death happens. So essentially, the kind of description of the arising of a moment of consciousness with all of its motivations, moods, and all of the feelings that have kind of come with the trajectory from our past, that in that moment, there's a kind of a momentum that takes us into the next moment. Kind of poop. You know, so in our daily lives, we can see that with more and more mindfulness, we begin to actually see the moment to moment nature of how karma unfolds. The traditional teaching is that at death, in the moment of the disappearance of consciousness, in this mind-body stream. That's all that we are, really, in this understanding, is a stream of body and mind processes rolling on, just cause and effect, and the ending of life in terms of the consciousness leaving at the last moment of life in this body, that it's really the consciousness and its intentions, its motivations, that has the forward momentum. And that forward momentum is understood to be pretty powerful in that forward momentum of mind is understood to be very powerful. And so at the dissolution of this body, that stream of consciousness is understood to simply arise again in another form, in another body, in a womb. So that's the traditional teaching, that moment after moment in this life, there's a stream actually of mind and body arising and passing. Consciousness arises in a moment with this mind and body, and then it disintegrates, and then it arises and passes, and it disintegrates. Like moment after moment, there's this process of a moment of experience, and that propulsion into the next moment, and the next moment of experience arises, and then the propulsion into the next moment. So it's like just moment after moment, this arising of experience. And the traditional understanding is that process is essentially, that death doesn't stop that process. That the especially the consciousness, the momentum of consciousness is propelled forward into, essentially landing into another life. So how does it work? I can't tell you. You know, how does it happen that that consciousness would arise in another, in a womb? I have no idea. You know, that's where my rational mind gets involved and says, not sure about this. Yeah. Oh, use the mic. Is it on? Can you hear Mary?
Well, no.
Okay, so I think the mic isn't working. Okay, we'll use the other one. The other reason to use the mics is so that people with the hearing assisted devices can hear.
Okay. Would that consciousness is in this sort of description or what, however, of consciousness? Is it separate from other consciousnesses?
But yes, essentially the kind of conscious, there's a consciousness stream. Uh-huh. We're each kind of consciousness streams. So it's not like my consciousness would end in this, you know, in my life, in this life, consciousness seems to be tied, connected to a particular form. So consciousness arising in passing moment to moment is consciousness and this form arising in passing moment to moment. It's not as if my consciousness is going to go out in my, or going to stop or like this, you know, the moment after moment arising in passing nature of consciousness is not going to go out in my mind stream and arise in your mind stream. That there's this kind of continuum that's a flow. You could think of it as a kind of a river. You know, that there's a kind of a channel in which that river flows. And the channel could be essentially our form, our body. You know, you have two rivers like really widely separated. It's not like the water in that one, which we could think about the consciousness. And this is not a perfect analogy, so don't like go too far with it. You know, the water in this one isn't going to somehow magically, it's a flow, right? I mean, the water is flowing. There's never the same water flowing through that river, but it's kind of got its coherence, that stream, and this stream have their coherence. It's not as if the water that's flowing down that river is somehow magically going to, like, transpose with the water flowing down the other river. So it's more like that, yeah, there's a kind of coherency. And that coherency, I think, is the place that we attribute self. Attribute entity, attribute a thing. Because there is this continuity, because there is this kind of, we see, you know, for instance, you know, I have memories, right? I know how I was when I was 5 years old. I have all these memories, and so those memories kind of congeal in a way to creating this sense of, well, I as a being, as an entity, have traveled through time and space, and you know, the proof is that I remember all these things. So I must be a thing. I must be an entity. So there's that coherence of that stream of consciousness, I think, is one of the key places that we confuse that coherence with a sense of me. And the teaching on karma, on cause and effect, is that, yes, there's a coherence, and yet it's a continually changing flow, like the water in the river. It's never the same water. And yet, it's still the river. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Anne.
This question's coming to my mind as you speak about this topic. I've had the sense that the Buddha is infallible. You know, we hear that talked about in Christianity. Is the Pope infallible? And quite a lot of argument about what Christianity is really about. I haven't heard that in Buddhism. I mean, maybe it's there, but there seems to be a coherence among the teachers and really a sense that the Buddha really was right on. People aren't saying, oh, but he didn't understand properly, because conditions have changed a lot since the Buddha was teaching. And yet, you know, his teachings just seem so contemporary as well.
I would say that in terms of understanding the human mind and how it creates suffering, the Buddha knew what he was talking about. There's a whole bunch of other things. And in fact, the Buddha said, one thing he said to people was, you know, what I teach is suffering and its end. Everything that I talk about is pointed in that direction. He said, there's a lot of other things that I know that are in my mind, but they're not relevant to this. Let's focus on this. Let's explore this topic. And so, yes, I think that that the Buddha knew what he was talking about with respect to suffering and the end of suffering. That's not necessarily saying that the Buddha was infallible in terms of everything that he did or said. I think that may be some. I mean, there are some teachings in the Theravada tradition, in particular, I think, of making the Buddha omniscient, infallible. It seems to be a commentarial tradition, you know, kind of almost a need to elevate the founder in a way. There's certainly not a need to have that belief in a way, I think. The encouragement, the Buddha, you know, in his life, he said, look in your experience. He said, don't go by, what other people have said. Don't go by, you know, what opinion says of what people say in the world, you know, by convention. Don't go by what your own rationality says. Don't go by what books have said. Don't go by what teachers have said. Look in your own experience. Does this create suffering or does it lead to happiness? So he wanted us to look at it in our own experience. And Arthur, I know this is, you've heard this kind of thing before.
It's a very big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question.
let me ask the question from a different perspective, and that is the historical Buddha and the times he lived in. So, and this sense that we're just, the last question about the infallibility
uh-huh.
of the Buddha. So he was a man. The culture he lived in, the common belief was rebirth. And
well, there is some truth to that, although there are plenty of teachers in the time of the Buddha that said, when the body dies, that's it. It wasn't just that rebirth was the norm of his time.
But I guess what I mean to say, that's correct.
Yes.
I forgot that.
Well, that is one of the pieces, the arguments that sometimes people make is that, you know, the Buddha taught rebirth because it was what everybody believed in his day. But that isn't the case. That there are plenty of people who, just as in our day, had a hard time believing in rebirth. And we do have to stop, but we could carry this on next week. if enough of you are here next week who are here this week, I may start with questions. So we'll see. We'll see how it is. How whether there's enough interest in questions. So thank you.